Well, it's a great privilege for me to be here. 4 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to talk to you. I wouldn't have been moving, and I certainly wouldn't have been singing. God, as a Christian psychiatrist told me recently, clearly intervened. And it's God that I want to give the praise and the glory to tonight. It's not anything that I've done at all. And I've already been encouraged. You've been singing about some of the verses that I'm going to read. And of course, I'm washed in that blood of the Lamb. And my prayer is that you'll be washed in the blood of the Lamb, because it's the only thing that will keep you for time and for eternity. And the musts, the two musts in the Bible, man must needs die, and the Lord said that you must be born again. If you just turn your Bibles, please, to very well-known verses, but I feel I need to be read tonight. The Word of God is quick and powerful, sharper than any two-edged sword, much more important than my words. And it's in John 3, verse 16, the Gospel of John. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. And turn back to the Psalms, please. Psalm 32 and verse 8. I'll not read all the scriptures for the sake of time tonight, but I will refer to them, so I'll apologise. It takes me a minute to look them up. Psalm 32, verse 8. I will instruct thee and teach thee in the way which thou shalt go. I will guide thee with mine eye. Now, I wasn't born into a Christian home. I didn't have the privilege of having two saved parents. To date, I only have one saved parent, my father. So please pray for my mother and my two brothers, they will come to Christ. Originally, I was 10 months old, lived in Carrick, Trevor's Lane, then we moved to Isle Magee. And there was a house bought with mushrooms on the stairs, I am told, and 25 acres. It was a bit of a wild adventure, but my mum and dad, seeing the view of Portmuck, they just fell in love with the place. So if anyone knows where that is, that was my playground growing up. Mum became a farmer because 25 acres was a bit much for a lawnmower, so that's how my mum got into beef farming. And my dad was a sign writer by trade. He would have done lorries like for Duke's Transport, never Ronnie Duke and Winston were in business there. So we'd have known, that was kind of circles that we knew. And before, growing up, I didn't really see Dad much, to be honest. He was, when he wasn't working, he was in the rugby club drinking. So booze and business were really his two main passions. But you know, God was good, and what I want to really acknowledge tonight is God's goodness and the prayers of God's people that preserved me and definitely were answered for my dad. His parents were saved for many, many years from Donegal originally, and Granda came to Belfast for work. In the 30s, you were sold. It was kind of a strange arrangement, but that's how you could work. So they came up to Belfast, and Granny, she got the engagement ring through the post, and that's how she came up to Belfast too. So they're great mentors in my life. Granny and Granda Clark, my mum's parents too, they were fantastic, godly Presbyterian people. I don't know if they were saved or not, I just don't know. But great mentors in my life. They Granda and Granny welcomed my brethren, and they were praying for us. And of course their sons that would come to Christ. So I was 9 before this massive change happened in my life. My dad was busy, and it was the 70s, so he was a bit of a hippie looking. He had long hair and a beard, and a bit scary looking if you met him in a dark night. But he was many a night driving home drunk. And I don't know if you know, from Carrick down McGee, there's the black hole and a cliff edge. And I don't know how he made it. Some nights Mum had to leave us, and I heard the Land Rover revving up, and she was going to get him because he couldn't drive home. And you know, children do pick up. I was only about 8 or 9 before that all was kicking off, and children do pick up. They know what's going on, even though they're not told. And it wasn't much fun for my mum either. and my two brothers, Garth, who's 2 years older, and Chris, 2 years younger than me. But I'd say a great change came. Dad didn't go to work. This was very unusual, and I was thinking, me being a bit nosy and the only girl, I was thinking, what's wrong? And we were told to be very quiet, and unknown to me, Dad was under great conviction of sin, and God was dealing in his life. He was the captain of the rugby club, and he knew if he hadn't got saved at that time, that he probably wouldn't have been saved. He wouldn't have been alive. So I thank God that he got saved in February 79, so I was 9 years of age. So all of a sudden, I had this man in my life. He was clean-shaven, turned up in a houndtooth suit and a black waistcoat, and said, right, we're going out to meetings. And I just thought all my Christmases came at once. So off we went to every meeting, and it was basically brother meetings, and you free peas got off lightly. A series of meetings for you guys is 2 weeks. The brother meeting 30 years ago was at least 10 weeks each series. So you were at meetings a lot, and it didn't matter how many homeworks you had or in the gut. You didn't get a choice. You were going. So Saturdays as well, I was with my dad. I became his shadow. And he was marking out a lorry. I was in the band, and I was ready to wash the boss's car and earn myself a pound. So it was great. And I began to meet godly people, again, who were praying for me and my family. And there was a lovely man, godly man from Ballinshee Gospel Hall, who's now with the Lord, Tommy Gilmore, and he had a great burden for the lost. And he had meetings in his barn, Gilmore's barn meetings, in Ballinmuir, and I came under great conviction of sin at that time, and it was 1980, it was the last week of the meetings, and I knew I had to be saved. I knew I was going to hell if I didn't repent of my sin. And an astonishing for me thing I felt happened, the preachers came to our home, and if you'd have seen our lane, you needed a four-wheel drive to get up it. If you had a tractor, it was very useful, it wasn't concrete in it. And they made the effort. I mean, Jim Martin was from Ballymena, and he came from Nye McGee with tracks. And Wilson Jennings, late Wilson Jennings, and Brethren as well, and left tracks at our home. And I thank God for gospel tracks. And any of you give out gospel tracks, please keep going, keep doing it. God will bless it. Now, I didn't want buttonholes by a hellfire and brimstone preacher. And the house was very quiet, but I sneaked down anyway to the kitchen and I found the wee booklet, God's Way of Salvation. I'm still saved, yeah, the wee white book with black lettering. But I took it in the living room and I looked it up and got how to be saved. I just was wanting to be saved, and I said, how to be saved. And it was John 3, verse 16. And I thought, well, I don't want anybody coming in here. You know, our farmhouse is busy. And I thought, I'll go up to my room and I'll get my Bible out. I'll make sure this book's telling me the truth. I was a great friend for the truth even then. So I just got on my knees and I said, God, I know I'm a sinner. And I need you to save me. And I was only 10 years old. I hadn't been into the Word, but I knew if I died, I would be in hell. I just asked God to save me. And he did. And that was the best day of my life. That was the 9th of April, 1980. And you would think, well, now you can sit down, Joanne, well, life's fine, you're going to heaven. If only life was so simple. Life has been great, but life has been hard. And I'm sure there's not one Christian here who will say that life is easy, that life's a breeze. But life with the Lord is wonderful. Life without the Lord must be torture. And the work that I do now, I do not know how people get through every day. So Daddy was going to the Gospel Hall now. He was a member. He was in the Brethren. I don't know if you know this terminology. Forgive me if you don't. They don't talk about churches that's been in the meeting. They teach that they're the only place where God has placed his name. So to be in the meeting was a big thing. And I was reading my Bible and I could see my need for baptism by immersion. And at 13 I went and requested that and I gave my testimony and they were very happy. But then the bombshell came. They also said, I think that you should be in the meeting straight away. Now that wasn't part of my plan. I just knew there and then I had a lot to live up to. There was a lot of rules, so we say. But that was over the moon, and it was like everything was great. But I wasn't really happy there. I didn't feel I could live up to it. And another thing happened to me, that three of my four grandparents died at that time. And that just threw me sideways. I didn't know how to cope with that. Unknown to all of us, I was also suffering a mental illness that no one knew I had. So there was a lot of dark thoughts, a lot of fearfulness. Behavior was changing. My sleep patterns weren't right. My moods were all over the place. But sure, every teenager's like that, aren't they? You know, this was nothing new. It's just grown up. But I seemed to have boundless amounts of energy. I would have moved my furniture 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I would have maybe stared out the window and looked at the moon and dreamed and got on and daydreamed, and it was a very strange carry-on. But of course, I didn't tell anybody any of this. I was petrified somebody would take me away or do something. So I was physically coping alone and in secret. I kept a coded diary in my bedroom. Every year when Dad would have got complimentary diaries, I was like wanting a whole lot of them, and they were like, what does she want, you know, a diary with a Holly Sperm's number on it? But I was using these to basically process my feelings, a better way to put it. And, you know, God was good because he had many coping mechanisms, if you like, in my life. Dad was an artist, or good interest in art. He's an artist by trade, obviously, but he collected art, and our home was full of art, and we would have been at art exhibitions and things, and it was the art really on the walls that was keeping me, I'm going to use the word sane. It was keeping me contained. It was keeping me somehow functioning. That's the only way I can describe it. I didn't find primary school very exciting because I was stuck in a room all day, the same day. But as soon as I got to secondary school, I took off, as if my brain opened up. And of course, every child, every young person goes through developmental stages, and those of you who will study that know that from those who teach. Children cope with things at different times and different ways and different levels, and that's what I was struggling with. Academically, I could remember anything if I had a colour. I couldn't remember anything if I had words. But my little code and way I'd done things, I was getting through, and I was in the top class for everything, and I was able to get on. And music became my solace as well. A music teacher gave me a clarinet, and I got a squeak out of it, and they said, well, you'll learn the clarinet. So that's how I got into music. But the brethren didn't have music. They didn't have music in their churches. So I felt very stinted with worship, that I couldn't worship with song and music. And so Dad and me would harmonize and sing and try to make a joyful noise. So we were, and he played the guitar. So we were always singing and getting on. So it was great, you know. And also, I baked, I made things. I seemed quite creative in my own way, and God's word was my lifeline and prayer, meditation. And you know, every psychiatrist and psychologist will tell you that you need to meditate, and they'll tell you yoga and all these nonsense things, and relax and chill out. You know, God already has everything we need to cope. Well, by 15, I had a life plan, and I was very disillusioned with Christians by then. I had met a lot of hypocrites, and quite frankly, I was just ready for the hills. I didn't really want to live here either because of the troubles, and I felt there was no real future for me. And again, God stepped in a marvelous way. I'd got to enough O-levels and things to go to grammar school, but secondary schools didn't do A-levels, but I didn't want to go to grammar school, so I went to Laren College and did catering. And it was a general course, and you could go to Port Rochester chef work or specialise. So I'd won a scholarship to Port Rochester. I didn't really want to go, but they made me go up anyway. So when I walked in, and the head guy was going on about this big bar, and it was about probably the size of this pulpit, actually. It was huge. And he said, by the end of the 2 years, you'll know the taste of every one of these drinks and liqueurs. And right there and then, I said, no siree. I had seen enough of what drink could do, and I had no notion of going to a college that was going to teach me the taste of alcohol. So I thank God for that, because that really changed my course of my life. I'm not saying anything pride for me, but it was just, there was no way I was going to go down that road. And of course, the tutor was utterly horrified, thinking, what are you doing? And I was like, I want to be a baker. I don't want to be a chef anyway. And a bakery then was like, that's for dunces and that's for weirdos and what are you doing, throwing your career away. But by the time I got home, there was a neighbour who needed an apprentice who had a bakery. And I started baking. And because I didn't need a lot of sleep, I could get up at 4 in the morning and start work at 5 and work to 1:30 and then go to college in Belfast from 2 to 9:30 and drive home an hour, 9:30 and then go to work again. So I don't know how I did it, but sure, everybody's doing that when they're young, don't you? You work hard. So there was nothing obvious wrong. And by 19, I had met Mr. Wrong. I'm married to Mr. Right now, but I'd met Mr. Wrong. My desire to get away, I suppose, was part of it. And College of Business Studies had, again, an option came to go to Austria to study patisserie, but of course I thought I was in love and I was promised the dream by another Christian, this Christian guy, so I stayed thinking that's what I should be doing. By age 26 I'd drifted into an engagement. We had a house built, and 12 weeks before the wedding I got a phone call to say the wedding was off and that the house would be sold in the morning. Now previous to that, the Lord had given me a verse. And you know, the Lord always gives you a verse. I didn't know how to memorize much, but anything I did know, God always kept it before my mind. And it's Proverbs 12, verse 22. Lying lips are abomination to the Lord, but they that deal truly are his delight. And you know, there's nothing worse than lied to, because really I just thought everybody said they were Christian was wonderful. I was a bit naive, I have to say, and I'm not here to bash any believers at all, but there are a few false ones. And the reason for his interest in me was obviously my dad's money. So I was basically jilted. I didn't know what to do. I was totally embarrassed to the point, well, when I got the news, I collapsed. I wasn't able to function. And that night, I thought, well, there's blue rope out in the farm, and there's a stairwell, and I could maybe end it all. Now, that thought came into my mind as quick. I can't tell you how quick, and it left as quick. But then I could hear Satan's voice mimicking the Lord's voice, saying, and then you'll be with your Jesus. Now, that is what's termed as suicidal ideation. I didn't like that thought. It just petrified me, and I did want to be with Jesus, of course. I wanted to be in heaven with him. And I looked over to the sea where our house was, and I could see the lights from heaven glistening on the sea, and I thought, God, I know you need me to live. Give me a reason to live. I went to the doctor as well and sat in front of a doctor, and maybe because it was a locum doctor that I told her this, I don't know, but I had to be honest with myself. And you know, whether you're saved tonight or not, you have to be honest. You have to be honest with yourself, because if you're not true to yourself, you can't be true to others. But you know, I'm being honest with you tonight, if you're not saved, that you're going to end up in a lost eternity. And it's not because people have this notion that if you're suicidal, you're going to hell, or that because Judas hung himself that he went to hell. Judas went to hell because he rejected the Lord Jesus Christ, the Savior. And anyway, I went to the GP. They just gave me beta blockers and told me everything would be fine. God as well was giving me that verse, I will instruct thee and teach thee the way that I shall go, I shall guide thee with mine eye. And he was really challenging me to leave the gospel hall at that time and the brethren. And again, that was a huge step, because you don't leave the brethren unless you die or are kicked out. So none of these options were going to happen for me. And I knew the consequences of leaving. But God was calling me, and I told one of the elders, it just happened to be a weekend, Dad wasn't there, very unusual, he never would have missed. But he was away in business, and he wouldn't be back till the evening. And I went out to that car park. There was nobody else there. And An elder's wife just said to me, if God is calling you, don't let anyone stop you. And God was calling, and he just told me to go. And sometimes those two letters, the word G-O, were very hard to do, because I knew what it was going to mean. So I told my dad, and I thought he took it very well. Then he exploded, and he told me that you and me finished. And at the time, I was also working for the family business. I had my own kind of wee sideline doing wedding cakes, but I was employed by the family business. I lived at home. And I stood at the fridge that night in our kitchen, and I knew there was two doors, and there was one to my bedroom and one to the yard, and I was taking one of those doors. And it was my mum who stood in and said, look, you've been hurt enough, and you're going nowhere. But it was very difficult. For example, I would come in the Sunday after going to Ballyclare Baptist. That's where I felt God led me to go. And Dad walked out. This is two Christians. These are two believers. This is what was happening. Now, don't be too hard on my dad, because God was showing me something through this process. What he was saying was, leave everything. Everything I'd given you now in life, I want you to leave it behind. Now, you've been engaged with this other person. Getting rid of him was like a divorce, even though we weren't married. And it took about 10 months. It was driving me crazy. But all these other things had happened in the meantime. I already knew that probably life at home wouldn't probably last much longer. I didn't know what was going to happen. I had no family really support apart from the Christian ones. But I didn't want to involve people and split the family and like that. So it was a very lonely place, I can tell you. I had no money. I was left with £6 in my bank account. But you know, whenever you step out for God, God will answer very quickly. And within a year, God had given me £6,000 of a grant from an agency. I don't even know how I got it, because I had no assets, I had nobody buying me to buy it, no guarantor for the bakery, and three houses in my own name. Now, I'm not telling you this to boast, I'm just telling you what God did, because I had to sign the house over to the other guy. And that really galled me, because I'd made a lot of money. The property was doing well in those days. But you know, the morning after I signed that property over, I went to work and I thought, well, heavy heart, lost everything. And there was black ice in the road, and before I knew it, I didn't see it, but I was going down this brae as a passenger. And I knew this jeep rolled, I was dead, or if I hit the bridge, stone bridge, it was definitely going, or a telegraph pole, I didn't know what. But I ended up anyway. I had a broken telegraph pole, obviously somebody had it before me. And that's where the jeep rested. Boy, I was mad. I love my car and I love motors, and it's no secret, but I said, Lord, what? I was mad. I was raging with God, and I said, God, what more do you want? My life. Imagine me saying that to God. And I got my answer. He says, yes, Joanne, not to take it, but to use it. So I just had to get on with things and swallow the humble pie, and I just worked for the next 4 years. I just worked. I had started a new church fellowship. I had new opportunities opened out. But I was still ostracized by those who I had grown up with. And if I had gone into Ballymena, people would have walked across the street. And that was just the reality of it. But I say, God was doing a great thing. When I turned up at Ballyclare, like Orphan Annie, I told the pastor everything, and I just expected him to say, right, there's the door. And I just said, that's okay. And I got great teaching. I went back to my foundation. I didn't even know whether I even see it. I was doubting whether I had any purpose in life. And remember, I'm dealing with an illness I didn't know I had. But I'd say I worked hard and I kept my head down, and I started in 2000. I went to Belfast Bible College to do a course, just a part-time course. And that was the first time I really found out about counselling. And the pastor also asked me to join the theology degree course that he was running. So that really opened my eyes. I was really drinking in a lot of teaching there, and working with youth as well, because you've got to understand, I didn't have any access to youth. There was no youth fellowships and brother meetings. There was no camps or anything like that. Or I'd never heard of ACRI Mission Board, for example, and that sort of thing. So I was exposed now to all these wonderful things. And I'd also met two wonderful girls, Louise and Vivian, and we'd started singing. Again, something new. There was no ministry in song, or women didn't get on platforms and sing and give their testimonies in brethren meetings. So this was all new to me, and I was having a ball. I must say, I was really getting somewhere, and I was just focusing on my service for the Lord. Gone out with other couple fellas, but I was really getting disillusioned with men by that stage as well, and I was hitting 30, and I thought, well, you know what, Lord, I don't think I'm going to be married and have kids. And that was a struggle for me to surrender my singleness. I had always wanted to be married and have children. But I thought at that point that was not going to happen. Oh, Ye of Little Faith comes to mind. I'd already met William at Ballyclare. So we had to go to the Baptist to get me, but sure. I wasn't interested. He wasn't interested in me. There was nothing there. But anyway, I've been reading the Book of Ruth. And God had said, he basically revealed who I was to marry. And that might sound a bit bizarre, but God works in mysterious ways in my life. So by 31, well, no, by 32, I met William by 31. 11 months later, we're married. So God moves quickly in my life when he wants me to do something. And it seems to be every time I surrender something, or he takes things out, it's as if he's just wanting to sweep clean and bring lots more in. So, again, all was rosy. I still had the bakery going and a wee bit of property were restored and got on. Me and Mum had done that. And I found out, expecting my first child, I was over the moon. But unfortunately, I ended up sick as a parrot, as they say. So any women here who suffered hyperemesis, you have my sympathy. So I ended up living in Aunt Mary Hospital on a drip and anti-sickness drugs and injections for basically nearly six months. The bakery had to go, couldn't book and bake. People wouldn't want wedding cakes with me doing that, so my purpose-built bakery, and Dad had come round with them because he had seen God work in my life, and he built me a brand new bakery. And I had the chance to go big and export and all those things, but I just wanted to have children. So God was good, and Ruth was born. She's here tonight. Hence the Book of Ruth, she's named after that amazing woman. And 3 months later, Rachel's on the way. So everything's going to plan. Well, not really, but that's the way it goes. And everything was, well, I was 32, and I thought, well, William and I both were getting on, there's no point in waiting. So sickness wasn't there at all. It was great, so I thought, this is all right. But then I was having thoughts that weren't normal. One day I was going to the bank and there was a wee bridge I was walking over and I just thought one of us liked to fall over that wee bridge. And I thought, don't like this. And then lodged my money, went up the street and there was a bus pulling out and I thought, I wonder if I like to fall in front of that bus. Now these were dreamy, strange thoughts. These weren't, I'm going to run out and do something. And that's the thing with depressive illnesses, it's not always a drastic thought that you're having, it's like a dreamy thing. So again, after the doctor I went that day, and a CPN was quickly issued, which is a community psychiatric nurse who came out to the home. And she was a godsend. She was basically telling me, look, you've had a lot of things happen very quick in your life, and you just need to adjust. And when I heard that word adjustment, that was just like a wee piece of the jigsaw. And I thought, that's grand, I can work with that. Little did I know what was ahead. Joel was born, Rich was born, she came very quick, so she was great. We had two wee babies, and then not long after, Joel's on the way. So things are happening, again, quicker than we ever expected, but we were so pleased. But unfortunately, I wasn't treated very well in Antrim, and I nearly lost him, and I nearly wasn't very well either after it. So I had a very traumatic and bad experience there, but I didn't go back to Antrim's, our home in Antrim. I went to Enmagee to convalesce for about 3 months. I wasn't very well at all. The sleep pattern was all over the place. I couldn't settle. I'd been given antidepressants, but my doctor didn't think I needed them, so I didn't have them. So things settled anyway, and we decided to wait before we'd have four. I don't know why I had this notion of having four, because I was one of three, whether I liked odd numbers or didn't like them, I don't know. But 2008, Joshua was born on the 15th of May in the Ulster. And I thought the Ulster was like a hotel. It was fantastic. If you ever get a chance to have a baby there, go. It's wonderful. And they chucked me out after 2 days. Well, they said, you three others, you know what you're doing by now, so cheerio. And my heart sank. I just wanted to be there looking after my wee baby. You know, when you need that couple of days, ladies, just to read the book that you never get finished, you know. Oh, it was great, and treatment was, again, postnatal depression. They thought they would start me earlier on a particular type of medication rather than symptoms getting maybe quickly too far ahead. And nobody was to know what was going to happen. There's no medical negligence here. There's nothing wrong with the medication I was given, per se. So I want to make that clear tonight. I'm a great advocate for medication. But no one knew that I didn't have, it wasn't postnatal depression I had, it was a different type of depression. So it was 12th of August 2008, it was Mum and Dad's anniversary, and I thought I'd go down with my chunky chicken down McGee and cook them a dinner. And I never got cooking that dinner, because when I sat in the chair, my feet were going numb, and then my legs, and then I up to my waist, and I'm busy saying, Dad, we need to get an ambulance here. And in Portmuck, you're an hour away from an ambulance or hospital, whether it be the Royal or Antrim. And he thought I had the flu, and he was bringing me blankets, dear love him. Mum was going, oh, you'll be all right, it's just a wee bit of, you know, you're just something else. And I'm going, no, and get William. William was in Coleraine, 60 miles away, visiting an uncle. And I was going, what am I going to do? My brother was there, he's now the farmer, and he was able, my daddy, to get me out of the kitchen into the living room. And I was going into a state of catalepsy, which basically means that locked-up syndrome. I'm completely locked up and paralysed. So I couldn't speak. I could hear, but I couldn't speak, and my eyes were just locked on the top of the door frame. That was very distressing, obviously, for my parents. Dad started to read Romans 8. What shall separate us from the love of God? And Mama thought I had a stroke. Dad thought I was dying. William told me 6 months later when he saw me, he thought I was dead. So it was a very traumatic situation, but thankfully I got taken down to him anyway in an ambulance and hospitalised. I was poked and prodded and bladdered, and nobody knew what was wrong. Sometimes I could speak, sometimes I couldn't. My eyelids would either lock and I couldn't open them, so they were poking at me and talking to me, but I couldn't respond. And I'm sure William was by himself. My parents were lost. I never had seen my parents look lost before. And they just came to me in the hospital, the doctors, and said, look, it's not physical, it's mental, you're going to Holywell. And that just struck terror into my heart. And Holywell is a mental institution. It was built in Victorian ages and it hasn't changed. So I knew what it meant to go to the funny farm. But it wasn't funny. And you know, I don't make jokes like that anymore. And off to Tober na Bean was where I went. But to me, in my head, I was at college. I thought it was at Glaren College because it had a canteen and it had young people in it. So I was going back, 17. And I apparently was getting too stimulated. But before I got taken to a different ward, I met some believers there. There was one girl who had lost her fiancé, Stephen. Every morning she put her white skirt on her bed. She didn't like my black Bible, she had a white Bible. My black Bible reminded her of his funeral. She couldn't read past Stephen's death in the Bible when he was stoned. That was a young girl who was a believer. Another young girl who's 21, Cambridge graduate, had suicidal thoughts every day and they couldn't treat her. I was meeting Christians in Holywell. I was also meeting the unsaved. Many young people who had terrible backgrounds, terrible things happened to them. Drug addiction, alcohol, you know, all the things that happened to people. And they walked about zombified. But at meal times I'd met two chefs. One was called John, and another guy, he was John as well, actually, and he was an executive chef, and I kept calling him Sir. Well, again, it was me and everything kept coming back, all your training from the catering days, and he says, oh, don't be calling me Sir. He says, I'm a nobody. My wife ran off with another man when I was away on a cruise ship catering. I know the stories, people might think, if you were all a bit off your heads, how would you know? But these were real people with real stories. Yes, we were all ill, but we were still congruent in the sense we knew what was going wrong. The younger chef, John, said to me, he says, what's wrong with you? And I said, I don't know. Well, he says, I'm a polar bear. And I went, right, okay. But I didn't know polar bear was short for bipolar. So, as I say, I was getting too much stimulation, and one day there was about 20 medics surrounded me to intervene and dragged me from that ward into a waiting red van. I was biting, I was fighting, I was doing everything I could. Believers who are heading into psychosis will do things that they wouldn't normally do. I can only describe that experience as being like a cow herded into a cattle trailer. It was inhumane. It was not very dignifying. And I'm glad nobody that knew me see me in that state. The nurse at the back, when we got to the other part, there was a big 15 men in blue uniforms waiting for me. Oh, she said, I don't think I'd have this to deal with today. And I turned around and says, who are you calling? And her drawer fell open. And I soon realised that when you're locked up in a mental institution, you're nothing but a this. You will not be believed. And there's nobody's really going to care much about you. Now again, I'm not here to run down the medical profession. I have a lot of respect, especially for those in mental health, but there are some who leave a lot to be desired. They had a job getting me into the lift, and up I went into PICU female, which is psychiatric intensive care unit. I was handed a letter saying you're now sectioned under the Mental Health Act of Northern Ireland. That meant nothing to me, only that I'm getting out of here. I'm not staying here. I wanted my baby. My parents wanted me to go private. They did everything they could, but were soon told the state sections you. So friend, it doesn't matter how much money you have. If you're mentally ill, you're sectioned under the Mental Health Act of Northern Ireland, and you will not get out until they say so. Apparently I'd seen the bars in the windows and I lost it. I don't remember that, and I thank God I don't. But I do remember most of that experience. I remember being told, I kept saying, how long am I going to be in here for? You know, I've just had a baby, what am I doing here? You'll be here at least 6 months. When I heard those words, you might as well have told me 60 years. And I'm conscious of time, and I'm going to get to the end as quick as possible here. Before I went in, I said, William, just get everyone you know who prays for me. I don't really care if they're brethren, free PE, Baptist, whoever they are, just pray. Pray for me. It was very hard for him, as you can imagine. He didn't know if I'd come out the same person as I went in. We didn't know what it meant for us as a family. Would our children still be with us? All these questions, but God was good. I'd seen 6 psychiatrists before I was diagnosed by the 7th, who was a Christian. Because, you know, Christians don't do evolution. Christians don't do coming from nothing and being nothing. So I was really confused in this medical profession with their philosophies and ideas. they couldn't understand why I hadn't got a history of multiple affairs and millions in debt and drug addiction or something. What is wrong with this woman? How can this happen? And I started telling them how I get saved. But I had to be very careful what I said. If I said that I'm indwelt with the Holy Spirit of God and hear God speak to me, you can imagine what was going to happen. Oh dear, still psychotic, hearing voices. So God told me to be quiet. And I was telling them I was a gospel singer and they were laughing. And I'm going, look, I'm a gospel singer and, you know, I make CDs. I've been on CDs and, I CDs for you here. And I was trying to get them the gospel. I had verses coming through my mind. I also had other voices in my head. But even in that, I still knew the still small voice of God. Can I assure you tonight, believers are not demon-possessed when they're psychotic. I have been told that. I have been made out to be that. And I can assure you that is not the case. And I thank God for the experiences I've had and the patients that I met. And that God opened the doors in 6 weeks. And I was never as glad to get out of a place in my life. I'll be honest with you. But I pray for those people every day that I met. The staff were amazed, not only that I had visitors, and I remember William McRae coming up and I was telling that to my brother, and they didn't know what to think. Brother? How she related to him? That's my brother in the Lord. I had my minister, Philip Millen, coming up. I had my family, other people as well. And one particular nurse said to me, she says, you know, sometimes we see this, a higher power at work. And I said, do you remember the day I showed you my CD? And only that my name was written on that CD, you wouldn't believe me who I was. And she said, yes. But she just said again, sometimes we see this, a higher power at work. And I says, yes, my Saviour that I've been telling you about. And she just couldn't believe it. And she got a CD, and I hope she listened to it. Now, you think that would be the end of the story, everything's hunky-dory and everything's great. But the Christian psychiatrist, you know, for eternity be grateful to that man, diagnosed me with bipolar affective disorder, which is a new name for manic depression. So the medication for the clinical depression, or if you like, postnatal, wouldn't have helped. And I was really suffering kind of an overdose of serotonin. When you're bipolar, mine's genetic, there's different types, but through family history, they didn't realise that it's genetic. But there's no biopsy, there's no brain scan, there's no blood test for this. So I kind of felt like a bit of a guinea pig. I didn't want to be branded mental. And I said that to my shame. Because I was born mental. I just didn't know until I was 38. But I felt that I had let William down. I felt I'd let my family down. I felt I had deceived people. I started having an identity crisis at 38, 40 years of age. Felt useless. I was struggling spiritually. I couldn't really come to terms with it. I didn't know anybody who had been like me, I suppose. I felt guilty that I'd opened a can of worms regarding my family's genetic history and mental health history. My family, meanwhile, felt guilty for giving it to me. There's all this guilt goes about. But while I was at home recovering, and it took about a year to get back on my feet, a lot of rehabilitation to do. The doctor, my GP, was fantastic. He, I suppose in his wisdom, he was trying to get me out of the house and wanted me to go to the gym. And as you can see, I'm no gym bunny, but exercising me don't really get on unless it's regarding a horse or something that's doing the exercise, not me. But I was on this treadmill and I was walking along and I just thought, what am I doing? Who am I now? What can I do? And of course, I just stated and was going off. Nobody's going to listen to you again. You're mental. I had to take a year out from the singing, so that didn't please me either, but I wasn't able to drive or do anything. I wasn't able to do it. So I had to be very sensible, had to be very, very, very diligent on sleep. And that's really been the issue. As I say, bipolar people naturally, they've discovered, produce too much serotonin. So that's why I could get up and be ready to bake at 4 in the morning. I didn't need the sleep that normal people would have need. I'm saying normal, dirty commas. But I was challenged again with support. There was plenty of support groups, secular groups, like Aware, Defeat Depression, and Cause, etc. But I'd say I couldn't drive, and I wasn't really ready for like a clipboard support thing. I didn't think I needed counselling. I had a faith minister, so I wasn't worried about that end of things. But I just was struggling. So I thought I would Google all the different denominations in Northern Ireland. And I was looking for a Christian support group. And to my disgust and horror, I didn't find any. And I started getting a bit grumpy, and why doesn't anybody care about mentally ill people? By then I'd also realised that there's quite a lot of stigma that follows mental illness. And that's the problem, we don't differentiate between mental illness and mental health. In 2009, a psychiatrist, I had to go to outpatients every month. I had a mental health social worker. I had people calling at my house, making sure I'd brushed my hair and brushed my teeth and could sit up straight. And it was very hard to work with that. I also felt I was being watched because I had 4 small children. Were they thinking I was going to harm the children? Did they think I was incapable of being a human being? But these people were doing their jobs. It was me that had the attitude problem. And you know, I had to be honest. And this is what this whole testimony is. Why all of a sudden did I not like my new label? Why was I struggling? Am I struggling because of pride? Good old pride. It's always in there. It's in all, every one of us. And I had to really get before God. I says, God, you've already broken me in my life before. And I'd asked you in Holly, well, what are you doing? I didn't ask why. I just said, what is your plan? And his plan was this. And with this I finish. I want you to gather together the outcasts of Israel. And that verse spoke to me because when I was in recovery, I was getting phone calls from believers and non-believers. It wasn't just Christians telling me that I wasn't alone, not by far, not by any stretch of the imagination. There was many believers who were not able to go to church, they weren't able to pray, they weren't able to read. And if I had a fiver for every time somebody told me, I've got a depression, sure that's up to the devil, isn't it? All you need to do is read and pray a bit more. If only it was that simple. Job had comforters that weren't much better than that. Job's poor wife gets a poor run on too, but she also had lost 10 children. People deal with grief and loss in different ways. And I had to learn very quick that I needed to open my heart, not only for the lost, but for the lonely and the despised and the outcasts of society. Because I was now one of them. And I was confused and hurt by the attitudes that I was receiving in my church community, not so much in Oddless Town, free by any means, but in a general sense. I could not understand why all of a sudden I was to be avoided, while I got the looks of pity, or why I just seemed to be ostracized again. Here I go again. I had gone out for God few years previous and I was ostracized. God had blessed my life and now I'm seeing the same ostracization. So God then said to me, why don't you do something about it? And I went, I hold on a minute. It's all very well, isn't it? Wanting. Where's the support group for me? Where's all God's people not doing for me? But God says, I want you to do something for them. So William and I prayed about it, we researched it, we talked to every person we could get our hands on who was either in psychiatry or psychology and hoping that they would all tell us to wise up. But not one person said it was a bad idea. So we started BAM Christian Fellowship, and BAM of course is a name for the Lord, but BAM stands for Believers All Living with Mental Illness. And we meet once a month in our living room, the first Thursday of every month. And we've been able to pray with believers who have mental health problems. Now, as I'll say, and I was declared in remission in 2009, so that's how that we are termed. If you are in remission, that means you're not in relapse, so you're okay. So I'd never heard that term unless somebody had cancer. But that's not really how we're perceived. People think we're still sick. And we can't function or contribute. Also, there's lots of restrictions. I can't drive. I can't have a 10-year license. I can have a 3-year license. I can't do jury service. I mustn't know right from wrong anymore, but I can understand why. But it's hard to get travel insurance. They think you want to hijack the plane, not just sit on it. You can't be a managing director of a company. And if you're an MP, you won't be standing in Parliament. So these are all things you find out as you go along. Nobody gives you this information. Nobody gives you the counselling you need from diagnosis. So I was so humble that I could draw alongside others and have a confidential email as well that I've had contact from south of Ireland and Scotland and all over. So God's really using that. It's a very small work. It's nothing glamorous. But it's a privilege to pray with those who can't pray for themselves. And just really, we've been blessed in our walk with God through this work. God then challenged me again to go back to college. And at 40 years of age, with 4 kids, I could see college far enough, but I applied for a foundation degree in counselling and psychotherapy, and to my total shock and amazement, got onto it. Clinical placement with that college means I had to go around different organisations looking for placement. You need 150 hours to qualify, and Lifeline contact you to give me a placement. So I'm now in Lifeline. That's the helpline for young folks and older folks too. It's for everyone. And I was shadowing a counsellor last week, and when I heard the stories of people at 11 o'clock in the morning, it would shock you. They're young people, they're old people. And I can't breach client confidentiality, but there was one young man, so high in drugs, threatening to hurt his mother. This is the society we're living in today, folks. I'm not here to scare anyone, but I want you to know that Christians also suffer. Their families also go through trials. And I do also, in my testimony, try to, I'm a suicide awareness and prevention advocate. I believe nobody needs to die of suicide. That depression is an illness, and it is treatable, and that mental illness is nothing to be ashamed of. And I just thank God tonight that He has given me so much, not only materially, because, as I said earlier, money doesn't matter, but He's given me this wonderful portion in 2 Peter. And this is for you all, and with this I'll close. 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 4. Whereby are given unto us succeeding great and precious promises, that by these ye might be partakers of the divine nature, having escaped the corruption that is in the world through lust, and beside this, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue. Unto virtue, knowledge. Unto knowledge, temperance. Unto temperance, patience. And be patient. Unto patience, godliness. Unto godliness, brotherly kindness. Unto brotherly kindness, charity. Or love. And if, there's a few ifs in this passage. For if these things be in you and abound, they make you that ye shall neither be barren, nor unfruitful in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. But he that lacketh these things is blind, and cannot see afar off, and hath forgotten that he was purged from his old sins. Wherefore, the rather, brethren, give diligence to make your calling and election sure. For if ye do all these things, ye shall never fall. God bless His word.